welcome everyone. For me at least, it's the first event that I've chaired at the Middle East Centre since the start of term. I'm Toby Dodge. It's my honour to be the director of the Middle East Centre as well here at LSE, as well as a professor in the International Relations Department. But it's my greater honour to welcome Lahore Talabani to speak about the fight against ISIS, the Kurds on the front line. Lahore knows what he's talking about. He's the head of the Zanyari Intelligence Agency and a founder of the counterterrorism group, and has been very much involved both in Kurdish politics and in Kurdish security, but also in the wider regional dynamics that have been linked to the evolution of the coalition against Daesh, especially since the seizure of Mosul. Lahore has agreed to speak for about maybe half an hour, and then we can get into questions and discussions right through till 7:30 if there's enough to talk about. So without further ado, thank you, Lahore.
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you for giving me this opportunity today to speak here. I want to apologise from the beginning. I'm on really heavy medication. I caught a cold. So if I go off rail every now and again, then my apologies. Should I talk about the offensive of Mosul? Because this is the focus of the media and politics, and the military is really on the offensive in Mosul. And then maybe I can go into Syria and then come back into Iraq, because this is all interconnected, yeah. if that's okay. So under the U.S.-led coalition, the supervision of the U.S.-led coalition, the offensive of Mosul is well underway. I would like to talk about the importance of Mosul both for the Iraqis and the ISIL forces. Mosul being the second largest city of Iraq after Baghdad, with a population of over 2.5 million people, and connecting Iraq both to Syria and Turkey geographically is very strategic for Iraq. And being the last stronghold of ISIL, the liberation of Mosul is very important and vital for the Iraqi forces. On the other hand, also for ISIS, I believe being the last stronghold of ISIL remaining in Iraq, and being the second capital of the Caliphate after Raqqa, also is also very important for the Daesh forces to try and defend the city. So I think it's going to be an interesting fight in Mosul. The plan is to retake the city of Mosul under the supervision of the U.S.-led coalition, with participation of multiple Iraqi forces, combination of Kurds, Arabs, Sunni, tribal council fighters. Also, I think there will be some Shiite militia also involved. I think there's only designated areas for the Kurdish Peshmerga and Shiite militia. Mosul is a very complex city, multi-ethnic, multi-religious city, so we have to be really careful on every step we want to take towards liberating Mosul. In KRG, we're really concerned about IDPs coming across the border. At the moment, KRG is hosting over 1.5 million refugees in KRG, a population of 4.5 million. We're hosting 1.5 million. And we believe there's still around over a million people inside Mosul. As we get closer to the liberation of Mosul, we expect a lot of people to come across towards KRG borders. And right now we're going through an economical crisis in KRG, so I think it's going to be really difficult if the international community doesn't come to the rescue of KRG and to give a helping hand on the refugee crisis that we could be facing during the Battle of Mosul. So we talked about the importance of Mosul for both the Iraqi government and ISIL forces. We talked about the civilians remaining inside Mosul, over a million people. Why I wanted to mention that, we saw recent assaults on Minbij in Syria, an operation that was supposed to take about 2 weeks, end up taking more than 3 months. And the reason for that was because there was 10,000 civilians still inside the city of Minbij, and ISIL coming up with new tactics and techniques all the time, they decided to use these human beings as human shields. And it worked out in their advantage, and it slowed down the process of the liberation of Minbij, because it makes it very difficult for the coalition to do precise airstrikes because of the fear of civilian casualties. So having that in mind, this was only 2 months ago, I think, Minbij was taken. So a small city like Minbij, taking 3 months. Mosul, with still 1 million civilians living inside Mosul, I think it could be a very slow process. We still have to wait and see, but I believe it will be a slow process, because ISIL is always one step ahead. They're coming up with new tactics and new techniques and procedures all the time to slow down the moving armies towards them. In the past, we've seen them do really well in setting up IEDs and mines to slow down forces coming towards them. So it's really worrying for us, still having that large number of civilians inside Mosul, how that's going to affect the fight, and how much casualties there will be on the civilian side. Like I said, in KRG, we're really concerned about IDPs coming across the border. Also, what we're concerned about, we believe as we get closer to the battle of Mosul, or to liberation of Mosul, the asymmetric threat against our region, and probably not only against our region, also globally, and European countries really should watch out. The more territory these guys lose, the more they will go back to the asymmetric warfare. We're trying to prepare for that as security services of KRG. We've seen in the recent months the threats have increased against KRG cities, Erbil, Sleimania, Duhok. And we're preparing better now as we get closer to the Battle of Mosul, because a lot of the time they use the IDPs to hide within the IDPs coming across the border. And on many occasions, on a weekly basis, we find sleeper cells within those IDPs that are currently in KRG that we're hosting. So we expect a lot of bad guys trying to mix up amongst the IDPs coming across KRG borders. This is something that really worries us. I'm going to cross a little bit into Syria, because it's all connected. I think the Battle of Mosul and Raqqa was planned to happen at around the same time. I think what happened with the Turkish intervention into Jarablus has changed that around a little bit. It would have been better. I think it would have made it easier for the Iraqis and the Syrian Kurds to start around the same time, because then ISIL wouldn't have been able to focus all its forces on one location. But I think what happened in Jarablus, with the Turks getting involved there, has slowed down that process. The YPG and the SDF forces are very concerned about what's happening on the northern border. So it's their right to be concerned, and they want to stop focusing on Raqqa. Because after Minbij, they were just about to shift focus onto Raqqa, under the US-led coalition there also. But I think the Turkish-backed forces entering Jarablus has slowed that down. And the Kurds in Syria right now and the SDF need some sort of reassurance from the coalition to make sure that they don't come any further south towards the areas they control right now. I think what the Turkish government was trying to do, or the Turkish army there, first of all, to try and protect the Sunni interest in Syria, or in northern Syria there, the Sunni interest going all the way to Al-Bab and Aleppo, and probably thinking about setting up a buffer zone between Turkey and between the hot areas in Syria. Another thing I think that what the Turkish government was trying to achieve through that is to stop the advance of the Kurdish forces in Syria, or advancing towards Afrin and connecting the three cantons of Jazeera, Kobani, and Afrin. And they've done a good job of that. They've slowed down the YPG The US is very hesitant now to allow YPG to go any further towards the east. Also, I think one other thing they were trying to achieve was, you know, with the YPG willing to participate in the fight of Raqqa, which is the last big battle in Syria against ISIL, would have given more recognition to YPG. Would have put them on the map even more. There would be more weapons, supplies, and training and ammunition given to YPG. So the Turkish government tried its best to distract YPG from participating in the Raqqa fight, and then they were given signals that if the YPG doesn't participate, the Turkish military is willing to liberate Raqqa, which I think it would be a huge mistake for the Turkish government to either participate in Raqqa or Mosul. You know, it's too far south for them in Raqqa, too deep into Syria with all the complexities that we're facing right now in Syria and all these different groups fighting each other. I think it would be a huge mistake for the Turkish government. So I'm hoping it's just flex of muscle that the Turkish government are trying to flex its muscle and saying these things about Mosul and Raqqa. Also, Mosul would be dangerous if the Turkish government decided to participate in Mosul, because that's a completely different story, participating in Mosul. That would encourage the Iranians, whether directly or indirectly, also get involved in the fight in Mosul. So we really hope the coalition, or the US-led coalition, controls these regional forces. And if they really want to play a role in liberating Mosul or Raqqa, it should be a positive role. It should be an advisory role to the local forces on the ground. It should be supporting with ammunition and weapons and air support. The coalition should not allow any Turkish troops enter Mosul. Mosul is a difficult city to control. During Saddam's rule, it was a difficult city to control. We saw during the coalition time being there, they found it difficult to stabilize the city. Post-coalition, the Iraqis lost half of the city to the terrorists and the extremist groups. So it's always been a difficult city to control. So for the Turkish government to think that they can bring Turkish forces into Mosul, this is what President Erdogan is saying, it's a huge mistake, you know, for the sake of the Turkish people and Turkish government and for the sake of people of Iraq. We should avoid that. The coalition partners should really, really try and stop from Turkish troops entering into Mosul, because, like I said, that will open the door for Iranians to get involved either directly or through their proxies, supporting the proxies they have control of in some parts of Iraq. And we could soon have a bigger mess than we're in right now. Turks and the Iranians fighting on Iraqi soil. We don't need this right now. So we hopefully can convince the Turkish government to avoid this. And we're hoping that this is just flex of muscle and it's just talks and it's not going to happen in real. We talked about KRG, so YPG. YPG and SDF, I could talk a little bit about that. They've been the most effective force on the ground in Syria. The only problem is that a lot of them are Kurds, so this is a problem sometimes. You can be effective, you can be a good person, you can be good people. If you're a Kurd, sometimes that's a problem in our neighborhood. I think with a little help of the coalition the coalition have provided to YPG and the SDF forces, they've gained so much. We saw in the past 4 or 5 years, billions of dollars went into Free Syrian Army, a lot of weapons and ammunition from different countries, superpowers, and they didn't achieve much. But we saw in the past year and a half the little help that was given to YPG and the Free Syrian Democratic Forces allowed White House spokesmen to come on TV once a week and say, this is what we gained today, this is what we did today. And it was all YPG and Free Syrian Democratic Forces with a little effort from the coalition forces. I think they should be recognized for that. Even though there's some sort of previous affiliation with some of the commanders of YPG with PKK, I always bring up this example of one of our top commanders in Kurdistan regional government, a guy called Aziz Waisi. He's the head of the Zerevani forces in KRG. He was a PKK commander in the mountains for 15 years. Now he's a top commander in KRG. And some of these commanders in Syria who fought alongside of PKK, most of them, a majority of them, are Syrian Kurds. They want to do what's best for Syria. So that was in the past. If they were affiliated with PKK, they want to do what's best for Syria and for their people in Syria. They have no interest of what's really happening on the other side of the border in Turkey. And really, the Turkish government should really come into terms with that. And the Turkish government deal with Aziz Weysi. They give him these men training. A guy that was in PKK for 15 years now is on the KRG. The same sort of a model could be used for some of the Syrian Kurds. Even though they were previously affiliated with PKK, now they're really interested or focused only on what's happening in Syria, and they don't want to have anything to do. And I think a good example of that is we've seen attacks in recent months against Turkish troops from the KRG border, from the Georgian border, and from the Armenian border. There's not been one single incident from YPG border into Turkey. So this is a good example that the YPG could be good neighbors of Turkey. And if the Turks show a bit of interest with those guys, they're more than willing to build a relationship with the Turkish government there and to protect those borders. It would be wise for the Turkish government to open up this dialogue with the YPG forces. I think the YPG have done exactly what the coalition have told them to. They've been very honest with the coalition on their relationships, whether it's with the Syrian government. There's a lot of speculation that they have a good relationship with the Syrian government. I can assure you guys now that's not true. I mean, we saw the last conflict between the YPG and Syrian forces in Hasaka. That's proof that there's no connection. This is, I think, Turkish propaganda and some other political parties in the region propaganda to make them look like that they're really under the influence of the Syrian regime. In the past, there was rumors that they were under the influence of the Iranian government. I can also tell you guys that's not true, because I've been involved in this relationship of YPG and the coalition, and I know they've been very very honest with their coalition partners. So they can still play a vital role in the future of Syria. They can play a vital role in the Battle of Raqqa, in liberation of Raqqa. They've shown good examples of governance in most of the cities they've taken. They try to get all the different ethnic and religious groups to participate in running their cities prior to taking any one of those cities. For example, the Minbij Council they set up, 6 months before taking Minbij. And so they have it ready with participants from different ethnicity backgrounds and religious backgrounds. So I think, Raqqa also, if it was put, if there was some sort of reassurances could be given to YPG and the SDF, they could very quickly maneuver or shift their forces towards Raqqa. Because it's not like what's happening in Iraq. In Iraq, it's multiple forces, Shiites, Sunnis, Peshmerga, regular Iraqi army, but there is YPG and SDF. It's very, they're very dynamic. They could really shift focus on towards Raqqa, and I think it would be wise to do so on the coalition's part, because it would really make the fight of Mosul a lot easier, because then the ISIL forces will be spread across the board, and it would make it easier for everybody. KRG, I'm going to come back into KRG. We have serious issues, economical issues that we're facing and that we have been facing for the past year and a half. It hasn't got any better, unfortunately, even though we're pumping more oil out of KRG. Even though some in the recent months the oil prices have gone up, but still we haven't been able to pay our civil servants and pay our brave Peshmergas who are risking their lives every day to protect their country. We've always encouraged KRG to go back to Baghdad. Recently we saw a move by President Barzani and some of the other political parties who went to Baghdad. We really encourage that. There's a constitution that protects, in the Iraqi constitution, the rights of the Kurds are protected. So why split away from Iraq right now and go and deal with a country, whether it's Turkey, whether it's Iran, where we have no rights and we have no guarantees that we will be protected? We're protected by the Iraqi constitution. It makes sense. We're still part of Iraq. It makes sense for us to have good communication and good dialogue with Baghdad. Okay, we have our differences sometimes on oil and gas, but we're still part of Iraq, so it's wise for us to go back and deal with Baghdad. As President Barzani and the team with him, we saw, went last week to Baghdad and had a lot of good meetings in Baghdad and a lot of positive, we had a positive vibe from those meetings. We're hoping that this could help our economic situation, or the mess we're in economically. So we're really encouraged, and I think the international community really should push for more dialogue like this with Baghdad, because we believe our future is still with Iraq. I know there's talks of independence from time to time, and referendum being held in KRG. My personal opinion on that would be, you know, it's every Kurd's dream to have a free, independent Kurdistan, but there's a right time and place for everything. With all the crises we're going through right now, having 950 kilometers of border with ISIL, sharing all these problems, with the economical crisis that we're in now and we don't have a way out right now, and with our Peshmergas being in a state they're in right now, we're not able to equip them really well, we're not able to pay them. I don't think it's wise to be talking about independence. And if we are going to be talking about independence, this needs to be done peacefully with Baghdad, with dialogue with Baghdad, and we want to stay good neighbors with Baghdad. We haven't done any of that. And another thing I forgot, we have a lot of internal issues, unfortunately. There needs to be a lot of social and political reconciliation within KRG before we can talk about independence. So because of all these factors, my personal opinion is it's not the right time to talk about independence. I think we should, again, encourage and praise our government for going back to Baghdad and dealing with the Iraqi government on that issue. I don't know what else I should cover. Like I said, I've taken a lot of medicine. My apologies. I go off rail from.
Let me draw you out on a couple of issues, and then we can move forward with that. I suppose overshadowing all of this, and overshadowing regional politics, but especially Iraqi politics, is the up-and-coming offensive against Mosul. Now, we don't want to speculate when it will start, but I suspect it'll be a long time coming and a long time to completion. But then, a lot of the issues that you very diplomatically touched upon, and a lot of the issues that drove the rise of Daesh in the first place, will come back to the forefront. So I was wondering, as a Kurd who will be involved, or you said will be involved in the fighting for the liberation of Mosul, what do you think the KRG's role will be in Mosul, and what after the liberation? And then what do you see as the main issues that need to be dealt with in Iraq after that?
I think it's very much possible to liberate Mosul, to remove ISIL from Mosul. I think post-ISIL Mosul is what we should be concentrating on. If we don't have a good plan for post-ISIL Mosul, I think it could be a disaster. First of all, we've got to reassure the Sunnis. You know, it's a majority Sunni city, Mosul, a province, with some Shiites, some good Christian community, Yazidis and Shabaks and Kakes and so on and so on. So it's a very complex city, but majority Sunni. I think it's very important that we reassure the Sunnis in Mosul and the Sunnis in Iraq in general that they will be part of decision-making in the future of Iraq, and they will be part of the political process in Baghdad. This is really, really important, whether it's the Iraqi government reassuring the Sunnis, whether it's through the coalition and through the international community. This is a key factor, I think. If the Sunnis don't feel like they're part of the decision-making in the future of Iraq, again, we could have serious issues. And one other thing that I wanted to point out, a lot of these Sunni territories taken over by ISIL, by the time we liberate them, they're completely, the infrastructure's gone. We've seen in Ramadi, we've seen in Fallujah, in Salah ad-Din, we've seen in Kobani, we've seen in Minbij, we will see in, I believe, in Raqqa and Mosul also. I don't think the Iraqi government or the Syrian government or the international community has the money to try and rebuild these cities. This is what really concerns me. These cities with no hospitals, no good healthcare, no education because all the schools are destroyed. A lot of unemployment. It's a breathing ground for extremist groups to start recruiting within these communities. And without having a political solution in Baghdad or in Damascus or in wherever you want to call it, again, ISIL could disappear within the next 3 or 4 months as a structure, as an organization. I'm worried that we could have another ISIL under a different name, different shape, different size, even more brutal, to be honest with you. So these are all things to consider. Is the international community willing to donate a lot of money to rebuild some of these cities, to rebuild these schools in these conflict zones that have been affected by the fight against Daesh? If not, I don't believe the Iraqi government has the money to rebuild some of these cities. And like I said, I'm worried that this is a breeding ground for extremists to recruit within these communities and these youngsters. And soon we could have another Daesh, like I said, under a different name. But again, we've got to reassure the Sunnis that they're part of the political process. Well, this is key, I think, because I think we had this issue in the past, and this helped ISIL to be created and to become to this monster that they are today. So again, it's the Iraqi government's job, and it's everybody's job, all the political parties, including the Kurds, to make sure everybody feels like they're part of the decision-making in Baghdad. Whether it's Shiites, Kurds, Sunnis, everybody has to play their role in this. Otherwise, like I said, we could have other problems like Daesh in the future.
I mean, one last point on Mosul, and I think it's a very sensible thing to reassure the Sunni residents of Mosul. But I suppose one of the ways of reassuring them, I assume, would be to say that once the Peshmerga have liberated Mosul, they'll leave straight away. Is that your understanding?
So I wanted to talk about that. I think the plan is for the Peshmerga not to enter the city of Mosul. The role of the Peshmerga and the Hashd al-Sha'bi will be on the outskirts of Mosul, designated areas for both Peshmerga and Hashd al-Sha'bi. I think the plan is for mainly the Iraqi special forces, the Golden Brigade, and some brigades of the federal police, and the Sunni militia or the Sunni tribal forces that they've created. They're hoping to push up the numbers on that. That could be some sort of reassurance for the Sunni population inside Mosul that, you know, these are good forces. So the Peshmerga and the Hashd al-Sha'bi are not entering inside the city of Mosul. This is part of the plan. Hopefully the coalition will stay very much engaged with the forces on the ground to make sure everybody plays by the rule. This is very important for the coalition to stay very close and engagement with the troops on the ground to make sure nobody steps out of line.
Excellent. That's very clear. Now, you spoke very eloquently and very passionately about the PYG, and you were sending, giving the Turkish government some advice about their relationship. I just wonder what the PYG's, the YPG's relationship with the PUK is and with Süleymaniye. I suppose what might keep, well, a lot of things might keep President Erdogan awake at night, but this idea of a kind of a transnational Kurdish movement, not only across the Turkish border, but into Iraq. So I think I'd certainly be fascinated to know about what the relationship. So you said you were played a key role in brokering or involved in the discussions between the YPG and the coalition. What's the relationship between Kurdish Peshmerga and YPG?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say PUK. PUK has a relationship with PYD, which is a political party, and there's a difference between PYD and YPG. A lot of people connect the two together, but YPG is completely different, structured different, and different command structure. So there's connection with PUK and other political parties in Syria. But the connection between my organization and the YPG started way before Kobani was taken. I personally, we came under a lot of pressure on our borders with ISIL in the past 2 years, especially on the arrival of ISIL. We were under a lot of pressure. We took a lot of casualties, and it was a nightmare. This is before the coalition got involved, or really got involved in supporting the Peshmerga forces. So we came up with the idea of if we could spread the forces of ISIL, because at the time they were only concentrating on Iraqi Kurdistan borders, and they were penetrating holes through our lines that the Peshmerga had set up, and almost Erbil almost came under threat and almost was taken by ISIL. They got so close. So we thought about, you know, engaging with YPG forces and building a relationship between the coalition and the YPG, because they were also they were fighting ISIL and other extremist groups 2 or 3 years before us, but they were not being noticed because they were Kurds and Turkey didn't want them to be noticed. So we thought, you know, by engaging with YPG and providing a bit of support where they could keep some ISIL forces busy inside Syria, it will take off the pressure on the KRG Peshmergas. We believe that's exactly what happened. The Battle of Kobani, the Battle of Minbij, is keeping ISIL so busy inside Syria where we don't have to do a lot of work in KRG territory, even though there's still a threat against KRG borders. We're sharing 950 kilometers border with ISIL, but I think the strategy worked. We're hitting them from both sides, both YPG and KRG forces. It's really weakened ISIL. If you compare to what ISIL was 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, ISIL is not the same ISIL, or the ISIL forces are not the same forces. Secondly, these guys are Kurds. They needed our help. I believe it was the right thing to do, even though I faced a lot of criticism from my government and my bosses. They didn't agree with my idea of supporting YPG. Some people within the government, they looked at YPG as a terrorist organization having strong ties with PKK, but I didn't believe so, to be honest with you. I became very friendly with a lot of the commanders on the ground, and these were Syrian Kurds. Okay, they had affiliation in the past with PKK, but I gave the example of Aziz Waisi, who was 15 years with PKK. Now he's one of our top generals. And most of those guys wanted to do what was best for their families in Syria and protect their families. So I believe it was the right thing to do. And there's a strong relationship between us and YPG, and I don't really hide it. I'm really proud of it, proud of the relationship we have with YPG. We played a major role in building a relationship between the U.S., first of all, and then other coalition partners. It took me a lot of hard work and a lot of traveling from country to country to tell people that YPG is not a terrorist organization. Yeah, we should be worried about Daesh. We should be worried about Jabhat al-Nusra. Not worried about YPG. And I think a lot of that has turned out to be true. There's a strong relationship between the coalition. The coalition saw that the YPG and the Syrian Democratic Forces were the most effective and truthful force on the ground in Syria. So I think something really good's come out of this. Like I said, I'm proud of what my organization has been able to do in building this relationship between the coalition forces and YPG. And I really, deep down, I believe in this relationship because I don't see YPG as a terrorist organization. They're completely two different things from PKK. And the proof for that is the Turkish government, like I said, they're protecting those borders. Not one single attack in the past 3 years has been launched from YPG territory into Turkey. Again, I encourage the Turkish government to build a relationship with YPG. It will be in their advantage, I believe.
Well, finally, let me, before I open it up, one final question around the future of the Kurdish regional government. You very straightforwardly, very transparently said that you committed to Kurdish independence like any Kurd would be, but you don't think the time is right for a referendum or a move away from Baghdad. That's very clear. I just wonder how, given the huge suffering of the Kurds, the fear, the undoubted fear they had about the rise of Baghdad's military power under Maliki before it's collapsed again, and the historical fears, how you would persuade Kurdish public opinion in the KRG that they shouldn't push as quickly as possible for independence with Baghdad being as weak as it is now?
Actually, it's not convincing the Kurdish public. The Kurdish public is convinced that this is not the right time, to be totally honest with you. It's convincing our politicians that this is not the right time, I would say. The Kurdish public, they see the economical crisis. They see the suffering of the Peshmerga. They see the political dividends between different Kurdish groups. They read this very well, and they know this is not the right time for independence, because only if Iran, Turkey, and the Iraqi government close its borders for a couple of months, we'll starve to death. You know, we have no way. We're landlocked. We have no way out. Unless one of these countries give us a green light for Kurdish independence, I think it's going to be very difficult. That's why I think we have a good opportunity in the future with Baghdad through dialogue, peacefully, to achieve this goal. But this is not the right time. So why unite a lot of these enemies in the region for something that we really believe that it's not possible and it's not the right time for it to happen? So again, I think it's convincing some of our politicians that this is not the right time. Otherwise, I can speak on behalf of the Kurdish public. They're really convinced that this is not the right time.
Okay, thank you. Right, I'll gather some questions. If you could say who you are and ask a question.
So how does it work, the ruling? You write down all the questions and then answer, or do you answer Chatham House rule?
We'll take them one at a time, I think, unless we run out of time. If you're peppered with questions, we'll bring them together. But one at a time to begin with, so we can keep track of them.
Okay, sure.
Yes.
Thank you very much, as always. You are very frank.
So I saw you in the States, right?
Yeah.
Who are you? Tell us who
sorry.
You are.
I am Naseeba Yunus. I direct the Task Force on the Future.
Are you following me everywhere? Or am I?
It's a coincidence. I wanted to ask about Mosul. Given that it's kind of KDP-dominated neck of the woods, how involved are... What's the proportion of KDP versus PUK Peshmerga that are going to be involved in that assault? And also, particularly pertinent to you because you're on the intelligence side, you've said that there's likely to be ISIS infiltration in the IDP flows that come out of the city. How do you organize screening so that you can effectively so you can effectively separate innocent civilians from ISIS supporters? Of course, in Fallujah, when the Hashd al-Sha'bi was conducting screenings, that was extremely controversial. You know, we still have 600 men missing. How does Kurdish intelligence organize screening so that it can be done fairly and effectively, and does not continue to further alienate Sunni public opinion? And are there ways in which the international community can help in the liberation of Mosul to do screening better?
Okay. So thank you, Sabi. It's good to see you again. So KDP-PUK, I think it's more of a KRG force. It's not KDP-PUK. How many? I believe it will be a mixture of, you know, the merged brigades, that the brigades we have that are joint brigades both from PUK and KDP. We're hoping that would be the case. This is what we're hearing from our coalition partners, that it would be a KRG force that's going to participate in the liberation of Mosul. On IDPs and ISIS hiding within IDPs coming across the border, look, it's a difficult task. We have been facing this problem in the past year and a half. And sometimes they have gone past the security checks, unfortunately, because a lot of the time these guys are coming across our borders without having any identification. So it's very difficult to verify who they are. We are in contact with the Iraqi intelligence and security entities, whether it's the national security of Baghdad and counterterrorism in Baghdad or the Iraqi Mukhabarat. We try to vet, send the names to Baghdad and get feedback from Baghdad to see if they really know who these people are. So there's good cooperation now between some of our security forces and Baghdad security forces. But like I said, it's a difficult task, but I think our secret, I shouldn't really tell you, but it's having good pre-intelligence is the way forward. We have a lot of experience with terrorist networks since 1999-2000, fighting Jund al-Islam, Ansar al-Islam, Al-Qaeda, Ansar al-Sunnah, on and on. The secret of our success at the time was, you know, penetrating those networks deep, and to have pre-information. Whenever there was an attack happening, we knew immediately that it was coming, and we would prepare for it. I think we've managed to penetrate, have deep penetration into ISIL networks. We're gathering a lot of good intelligence, whether it's human or SIGINT or a combination of both. This is what we rely on, is good intelligence. Hopefully that will help us. But like I said, we're not going to be able to be 100% because this is a lot of people coming across, people who've been traumatized, you know, coming out of war zones. Sometimes you have to let them in very quickly. But there's follow-ons. We investigate further on. But it's becoming more and more difficult, to be honest with you. But Touchwood, so far, we're doing an okay job. I mean, if you compare what's happening in KRG and KRG security to other parts of Iraq or what's happening in other countries, you know, we work round the clock. I never had grey hairs before the arrival of ISIL. I've got grey hairs now. So, but yeah, we try our best.
Okay, who's next? Right, yes, you. The microphone is coming.
Hi, my name is Kirsten. I'm a student here at LSE.
Kirsten, it's a hard one.
You'll probably never see me again. So, I do have two questions for you. So I'll start with one. Given the conflict with PKK and all of the attacks that are going on throughout Turkey and Alazza and Tunceli and Diyarbakir and Gaziantep, and I know that you're stating also that you're creating this separate entity. I was wondering, going forward, if you're going to try to disassociate more and more from the PKK that's currently in Turkey, or if you see in the future uniting with them and kind of trying to unify or trying to, because it's very difficult, I think, for Turks to look at them and see a separate entity when looking at you. I think that's kind of an ongoing issue.
Okay, I was very clear. I was talking about YPG, and why the big difference between YPG, even though there was previous connections. What I was talking about was YPG and our good relationships with YPG. We've tried to mediate between PKK and the Turkish government. I personally have tried to mediate in the past, but unfortunately, when they lost the elections, President Erdogan, you know, they a complete shift of policy, and the peace process was destroyed, and the war started again with PKK. Again, look, the Kurdish issue in Turkey, I believe there's no military solution, neither for the Turkish government or for the PKK. I believe, again, they need to sit down and sort this out peacefully, and they need to find a political solution for this situation, you know. I always told my Turkish counterparts, you could eliminate the 2,000 PKK fighters in the mountain, but they would only be replaced by 3 million other Kurds inside Turkey. So there's no solution militarily. Again, we encourage both sides, and we still do, that they should go back to the peace process. That's the only way forward to resolving the Kurdish issue in Turkey.
And then my second question is, we're very fortunate and very happy to have you, of course, but given all of the conflict that's going on currently, how did we get so fortunate to have you here tonight?
She's asking you what you're doing. What's your mission in London?
So this was my main mission, actually. This was my only public. Most of the other talks I had was closed door. This one was the only public one. I was in Cambridge yesterday, and I have some official meetings as well. I try to come back here once a year. But unfortunately, I tell you guys something, and I was really concerned on the way here, because 2 years ago, I was in an official meeting here, and Daesh took over Mosul. They gave me the news that Daesh has taken over Mosul, and I was on my way out to the States. I had to cancel my U.S. trip and immediately go back to Iraq. The year later I came, I don't remember if it was the Sinjar incident. Again, I was in the U.K. with official meetings with the same people, and then that happened. I immediately had to go back. So when they told me you have to go to the U.K. this year, I was really worried. Thank God, though, Mosul, but it's taken back. This would be a good story. So I do try and come back to the U.K. and do the rounds, whether it's USA, U.K., and other coalition partners once a year to speak to high officials and counterparts.
Right, I see a sea of hands.
And I knew you guys would be here, that's why I really came.
I see. So I'll go actually just to the gentleman with the long hair and the glasses, and then we can come back to this.
I think you're referring to me. Hi, Ahmed Mehdi. Nice to meet you. Thank you very much for your speech. I have two questions, actually. The first one is you started off talking about the disruptive elements to, or potentially disruptive elements to, the Mosul operation. And I suppose without actually making a proposition, but just sort of speculating, maybe one of those disruptive elements is the growing sort of fragmentation within the KRG between the PUK and the KDP, and some of the casual, you know, political casualties as a result of that. Most recently, the parliament's decision in Baghdad to dismiss the finance minister, who was a Kurd allied with the KDP. And I suppose the second question is, so the first question to that is really, to what extent is the disunity between the KDP and the PUK at the moment going to actually impact the Mosul operation? And the second question is, you talked about the financial troubles at the moment in the KRG, and my point is really about Kirkuk in terms of the recent deal between the KRG and Baghdad over Kirkuk. Again, I sort of put it to you, is it true that the PUK was actually against that deal? And if the KRG is in so much financial distress, why was it against that deal?
This is in regards to the 150,000 barrels that was mentioned. Okay, so that's not my... Okay, so the PUK-KDP, I don't think it has any effect on the, or is any kind of obstruction in the fight or in liberation of Mosul. We've showed the United Front, you know, when Kagh Masood went to Baghdad, our PUK commanders were present. When the coalition came with Mr. Falah Fayyad and other partners in Iraq, our people were present in the meetings, and in signing an agreement with KRG, we were all present. This internal political issue, I don't think it's going to have an effect, because our Peshmergas have shown real unity, whether it's KDP, PUK. So I don't think that's going to have any effect, or it's going to be any kind of obstacle in the process of liberation of Mosul. We talked about the 150,000 barrels recently. I think around 4 or 5 months ago, some disagreements between KRG and Iraqi government stopped this 150,000 barrels of oil from south of Kirkuk being pumped into the KRG pipeline. And we were trying to come up, SPUK, from where I'm hearing and from what I'm understanding, to find a way where the people of where the people of Kirkuk could directly benefit from this, you know, because there's a lot of oil being taken from Kirkuk and being pumped into Turkish pipeline, and there's not a lot of money coming back into Kirkuk. And PUK holding majority seats in Kirkuk. We have 6 seats out of the 12 seats. Of course, the Kurdish bloc is 8 seats out of, with KDP seats, 8 seats. We're being blamed for all this oil being taken out of Kirkuk oil fields and no money pouring back into Kirkuk. So it was PUK's responsibility to really try and do something about this. When we realized that there's no agreement could be reached between KRG and Iraqi government, we proposed something to the Iraqi government where if we could sell this oil, we get companies to sell this oil, whether it's through Iran or through Turkey or any other means, and the money somehow pours back into Kirkuk, under the control of the governor of Kirkuk. That was the idea. Unfortunately, the media made a big deal out of it, and then immediately people within KRG, they went to Baghdad and tried to... I think that helped. That move by PUK helped this relationship between Baghdad and KRG, in a way. People that were not willing to deal with Baghdad, when they saw this oil could be going in a different direction, immediately went to Baghdad and made a deal with Baghdad. So people really should thank us for proposing that.
Yes, gentleman with the black glasses and the grey jumper, if you put your hand up above your head, the mic will come to you.
Thank you. Student of War Studies at King's College London. Countering terrorism requires more than just counterterrorism. What do you believe that Iraq must do after the military victory over ISIS to counter violent extremism?
Yes, I think I mentioned before, I'm really concerned about post-Daesh Iraq, you know. The destruction that we're facing in those conflict zones, like I said, you know, it's going to bring up a generation with no education, with no good healthcare, no, a lot of unemployment. This is a breathing ground. This is something that we need to think about seriously and find the money from somewhere to try and rebuild some of the cities. And like I said, ISIL could be destroyed or could vanish within 3 or 4 months as an organization, but the ideology will definitely stay behind. And in the past, we haven't done a good job of fighting the ideology and de-radicalization programs. Most of the concentration has been on, you know, militarily trying to destroy these extremist groups. In the past, with ourselves as well, KRG, whether it was Ansar al-Islam, Jundal al-Islam, we always concentrated on the military campaign and how we could destroy these guys and kill as many as possible. We never concentrated on how to de-radicalize and to fight the ideology. So I believe the Iraqi government needs to take this very seriously and have joint programs with international partners on de-radicalization. This is, I think, that would be a good solution.
Yes. Next door, Yusuf. Have we got a mic in the middle there? You wave your hand above your head, they'll know where to go.
Hi, also a postgrad student at King's College. So thank you so much for the talk. It's really interesting and lots of questions I want to ask you. But one is, there have been a lot of reports that a lot of the ISIL fighters have been Kurds. And so what do you think the reason for that is? And
where is that report coming out of?
I've read it on the internet, I'd say.
ISIS have released Kurdish.
Oh, definitely. There's a number. We have the numbers. There are probably about 300 to 400 Kurds amongst. I don't think that's a large number, considering where we are geographically and all the previous terrorism we faced in the past. I don't think that's a large number. There's probably more people from the UK than the Kurds. There is, seriously. From Germany, from Netherlands, you know, the numbers are much higher than. So we've been really lucky on this one, to be honest with you. I think the brutality of ISIL at the beginning really discouraged a lot of the Kurds in joining ISIL. But the numbers are probably around 400, 450, we believe, that we know of. So they have a special brigade. The Salah ad-Din Brigade is allocated for the Kurds. Well, their numbers are going down on a daily basis.
Hi, thank you. I'm Chris Bowers. I'm a former Consul General. I think, not sure we actually met when I was there, but I mean, first look, as it says, Kurds are on the front line, so thank you for everything you do to keep not only Kurdistan safe and the people who live there, but also what you do to keep people safe around the world, and thank you. I mean, it's fantastic work that you do. I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the your contacts with the Shia militia, because of course the other neighbour that you have, you know, around Tours and that sort of place, people like, you know, the Hadi Amr and what have you, and who've also said some reasonably hostile and bombastic things about Kirkuk and Kurdish control of Kirkuk. I know he's on the hiding to nothing there, but I mean, they're not necessarily, I'm sure you know, very positive always towards the Kurds. So I just wonder how your relations are with them. How do you see that going forward in the next couple of years?
Okay, so we need to divide the Shiites into different groups. I think not all Shiite militia are bad people. We have bad people in Kurdistan. Also, you know, people like Hadi al-Amri, we go back a long way during the Iran-Iraq war. We fought alongside each other, both KDP and PUK, fighting against Saddam's regime. So there's deep relationships with the groups like that. There are some groups within the Shiite militia that we're concerned about, but we believe this is an issue that we can raise with the Iraqi government post ISIL Iraq, that the Iraqi government somehow integrates these Shiite militias into the local police force, whether it's the military or the federal police. This is a problem for the Iraqi government. We hope that we don't come across any kind of conflict with Shiite militias on our borders. Again, this dialogue between us and Baghdad, I think, will help. We saw President Barzani for the first time praise the role of the Shiite militias and the lives that they gave. This is a change. This is good for this kind of messaging, you know, to keep them friendly with us. But again, I think it's the job of the Iraqi government post Daesh Iraq for these militias to be take this structure they're under right now. They need to be removed from the structure and integrated into more structured, like police force, military, and other official entities of the Iraqi government. There is some concern at times. Like I said, there are some groups within those Shiite militias that get up to no good from time to time. But like I said, it's an issue that we need to raise with the Iraqi government, and we need to solve this together in the future.
Okay. Yes, you, sir. And then up there afterwards. So you Mike down here. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. So my name is Chris. I'm a third-year international relations student at King's, so right across the street.
Congratulations.
And I'm writing my dissertation on Kurdistan, so thank you so much for your presentation, and it's been very enlightening. My question is regarding independence. We know that Turkey has been very repressive of Kurdish rights. However, we know on the Iraqi side that Erbil is an example of a very established society. So my question is whether independence, whether it's a distant dream or not, will it happen as a whole across all four countries, or could it happen, could we see an Iraqi Kurdistan come first before an entirety?
Yes, good question. I think happening in one part is difficult enough. We talked about that earlier. Can you imagine if you had the Iranian government and the Turkish government and the Syrian government also getting involved in this? It's going to be really difficult. I think it would be a dream for every Kurd that it happened all at once, but I think that's going to be very difficult. It needs to happen step by step. Iraqi Kurdistan has a good opportunity, but this needs to happen peacefully in the future with the approval of Baghdad, because we need to stay good neighbors with Iraq if this was to happen, I believe.
Professor, you've been very patient there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jean Roche Kelech from Middlesex University. I'm sorry I was a bit late. Maybe you have talked about these issues in terms of the recent tension between Iraqi government and Turkish government due to the Turkish military bases in Kurdistan and also in Mosul. How would you interpret this tension? Do you think this tension will cause further conflict between Iraqi and Turkish government?
Yeah, so I think we talked about it in brief. It's very important the regional players stay out of this Mosul battle, whether it's Turkey, whether it's Iran. One thing that makes me happy on this battle, I think, comparing it to Ramadi and Fallujah, you know, there was more of a dominant Iranian role. It came across that way. What we've seen for the Mosul liberation, we've seen a very dominant US-led coalition role. And this is reassuring for the people of Mosul also. And I think it needs to stay that way. And the Turkish troops, the Iranian troops, unless they are asked and given approval by the Iraqi government, they should stay out of this battle. There are enough local forces available right now, whether it's Sunni, Shiite, Kurdish, Peshmerga, to be able to liberate Mosul. We don't need forces from outside to come in to this. So it's the job of the coalition to make sure that there's no regional participation. And if they are going to participate, again, it needs to be a positive participation, whether it's advisory role, whether it's providing weapon and ammunition to the local forces on the ground. That's the only thing that should be allowed.
Right, yes, you, sir, and then you, and then you.
Thank you. Stephen, I'm a master's student in conflict studies here at the LSE. I have sort of a twofold question related to the Peshmerga. You've made some comments about how, despite, you know, lack of payment and being poorly equipped, the Peshmerga are still, you know, valiantly fighting, which I think we can all say that we're quite thankful for. But my question is related to loyalty and morale. How has the Peshmerga remained loyal to the KRG despite sort of having these stresses against them? And I was just sort of wondering what factors are sort of forcing or sort of... Where's the loyalty coming from? And then the second part of that is morale. How has morale been maintained within the Peshmerga in a way that was not really seen with the Iraqi military or Iraqi military earlier on in this conflict, despite being trained and equipped by the United States to such a degree?
Thanks.
So why have you done it better than the Americans?
So the loyalty is there, the Peshmerga. You know, just the name is has a meaning. They're willing to give their lives to protect their people, whether KRG pays them or not. They're protecting their families. If they don't stand against ISIL on those borders, there ISIL, you know, could take over cities like Sleimani and Erbil, and their families would be affected by that. So I think they see this and they take pride in protecting their country. But really, KRG should provide the basic needs for the Peshmerga. But whether they provide it or not, the Peshmerga, I think, you know, they will be loyal in protecting their land and protecting their people. The morale of the Peshmerga was always high. I believe at the beginning of the arrival of ISIL into Mosul, we saw how brutally ISIL went through Syrian territory. We saw how brutally came into Mosul and other parts of Iraq. I think my unit, I should really praise my unit. There's a military unit, the counterterrorism group, even though I'm not directly in charge, but it falls under my command structure of my intelligence organization, were the first people to take the fight back to ISIL and really showed the world and everybody else that ISIL could be really beaten. We beat them at the first battle. We really taught them a good lesson, and I think that was the beginning of, you know, a morale boost for the Peshmerga, because at the beginning, even the Peshmerga, not having the right weapons, not having the right ammunition, you know, can you imagine a Mad Max looking vehicle coming towards you, fully armored, with suicide bomber driving towards you, and you have nothing to destroy this weapon? Your morale will be zero, even if you're the bravest person on this earth. That happened with the Peshmerga because they didn't have the right weapons to destroy these suicide vehicles coming towards them. But we were better trained, had better equipment, and at times, I had to send two vehicles to one location, another two vehicles, just for a morale booster. That way, these guys, we could really beat them. And I think it was really effective. And we boosted up the morale of the Peshmerga. And then, thankfully, the help of the coalition arriving with the air support, with the ammunition and weapons supply, we're grateful. I think without the help of the coalition, you know, Soleimani, Erbil, and other cities could be exactly like Mosul is right now. So we're really thankful for all the help we've got from the coalition. Without them, you know, like I said, it will be a different story in our region as well. That's not to say that we don't need any more help. We need this help to continue.
Right, there was a question. Yes, you, thanks. And then you.
Thank you so much. Gabriel Garum from War Studies Department, PhD at King's. My question is, you talked about the necessary involvement of Sunni forces in the Mosul campaign in order to reassure local population. Regarding Raqqa, and how I know the SDF is a very multi-ethnic and multi-language as well, and multi-identity force, but how a heavily Kurdish intervention in Raqqa will reassure an Arab Sunni city as Raqqa, and especially after two years and a half of heavy socialization of the Islamic State.
So I think, like I said, Mosul is more complex than Raqqa is. We talked about the different ethnic groups, different religious groups living inside Mosul. It makes it really complex. But it's a majority Sunni province, and they're nationalist, Arab nationalist, a lot of these Sunnis. They needed reassurance from the Iraqi government, from the coalition. And I think participation of these local tribesmen is some kind of reassurance that, you know, no force is going to come and commit crimes against the Sunni community. But with Raqqa, it's a different story, I believe. You know, Raqqa, all Sunnis, Kurdish participation would be through Democratic Syrian Democratic Forces. You know, the Syrian Democratic Forces is a combination of Kurds. Even though a lot of people are saying that majority Kurds, because the YPG, it was YPG's idea at the first time to start including Arabs and Turkmens and the Christian community in Syria. So they are a majority Kurd. But I think if the focus is on Raqqa, we could really increase the numbers of Sunni Arabs and Christians and Turkmens within the ranks of SDF. If people see that Raqqa is going to be the next battle, I believe, through talking to YPG commanders, they're reassuring me that they're in touch with some local tribes people inside Raqqa, and they've shown willingness to participate in retaking Raqqa. So I think the numbers of the Arabs and the Christians and the Turkmens could easily go up as it picks up momentum towards liberation. So it's not going to be a purely Kurdish force that's going to take Raqqa. This is not what YPG wants. I've been involved in some talks between the coalition and the YPG. Actually, the YPG is quite hesitant to participate in Raqqa unless they can recruit more Arabs. And it should be an SDF-led force going into Raqqa.
Yes, sir.
Adrian, student at LSE, political economy. I wanted to ask you about Syria. So following the Turkish intervention in order to prevent the YPG to achieve territorial continuity, we have seen the U.S. Withdrawing progressively their support to the YPG under the conditionality, at least Joe Biden said in August, that the Kurdish forces should actually handle back Manbij. Do you think that it could be that the Kurdish forces could go on the Russian side, and what would be the implication for that?
So I don't know where you've seen withdrawal from the U.S. side.
The support to the Kurds, withdrawal of their support.
No, they haven't done. I think that when Jarablus happened and Turkish-backed forces came into Jarablus, even though there was a message from Mr. Joe Biden, but immediately the White House came out and said we're going to continue the support for the Kurdish forces and the SDF in Syria to recover on that one. I think that was... that wasn't very accurate. And then I met with military commanders in Iraq that went into Syria and reassured the YPG forces that they're not going to turn their back on the YPG. Even if this is not out in the media, I am telling you this is the case. I believe the YPG has been reassured by the coalition that they will not allow any of these forces to come any further south towards the areas under the control of YPG. So I don't think there will be any need for YPG to be looking into building a relationship with Russia. Building a relationship with Russia in Syria for YPG is a big mistake. I think Russians are tactical. They're not very strategic in Syria. I believe they need to stick with the coalition current relationship and develop this current relationship and reassure the Turkish government also that they will not pose a threat in the future. They need to continuously give this kind of reassurances for the Turkish government and for the coalition. And I believe they would be in good hands if they do this.
Yeah.
Ian Black from the Middle East Centre, talked recently from the Guardian. I wonder, I was listening to you talk about the coalition and your relationship with them, and you're very positive about them. I just wonder, standing back, looking at the larger regional picture, on Syria in particular, which is, I mean, your focus is naturally on KRG and Daesh and so on, but in the big picture, standing back, do you think that the coalition has done as well in Syria as you appear to think it's doing in Iraq? Had there been moments in the last few years, for example, August 2013, where you think that the coalition could have done more to contain the Syrian crisis? Whatever progress is made with Mosul and Daesh, the Syrian crisis is not only nowhere near resolution, but seems to be getting worse. I just wonder how that would look to you from your perspective.
So we're talking about all of Syria, not only the Kurdish northern part of Syria. I think coalition made big mistakes in the beginning. As I mentioned in the past, they trusted these so-called moderate forces in Syria, poured billions of dollars of money into these joint projects they had with Turkey and the Gulf states. A lot of these guys ended up joining either Jabhat al-Nusra or Daesh, to be honest with you, taking their weapons and money that was provided by the coalition partners, unfortunately, and they helped in creating this monster called Daesh. I think they made a lot of mistakes in the past, but I want to talk about the past year and a half, 2 years, where we've got the coalition to focus on building a relationship with YPG and how much they've achieved. For the little help that they give to YPG. We praise that the role of coalition that they have with YPG, and they've achieved so much. They've taken so much territory back from ISIL through the help they're giving to YPG. But I totally agree with you. Their role in the past wasn't a good one. They were misguided and misled, I believe, the coalition, by regional countries. And we have this mess that we have in Syria, which is really unfortunate for Syrian people. We saw the recent events in Aleppo. It's really, really distraughting, and I really don't know what to say about that. But it's so complicated now in Syria with the Russian factor, with the Iranians, with the Turks, with the Gulf states. If anybody really could figure out this puzzle of how to solve Syria, you know, it would be a great thing, but it's really complicated. So that's why we try and concentrate on, you know, the YPG, because they've been a good, encouraging, positive force in Syria. In the last 5 years, I think what YPG has achieved has been the only positive thing in the war against terrorist groups in Syria that's come out. Therefore, they should be given more recognition for that. And we should praise the coalition for building this relationship with YPG and encourage them, not discourage them, even though they messed up in the past. They made a lot of mistakes.
Right, let's take a final our speaker's energy is flagging. I can take it. We'll take a final round of questions. You first, sir.
And you, the last three.
I'm Andrew Caron, PhD in IR here at the LSE. My thesis focuses on the role of intelligence operation on military victory and defeat. So I'm here just because I want to know something.
I should take you to Mosul and get the real experience.
Actually, I want to talk to you 1 minute at the end, if it's possible. My question is this. You said two different things today. The first was a secret, the fact that the intelligence matters in military to achieve military successes. And then you talk about the material support you received from the coalition. So my question is, what do you think impacted the most on the successes you achieved? The material support or the information you gathered on the field?
Hold that and we'll take two more.
You got I should have wrote that down. Okay.
So it's what success, material support or intelligence?
Hi, my name's Rohan. I'm at King's College London, and I was actually at Singapore's Middle East Institute right before Professor Dodge was there. My question is regarding the leadership of ISIL, specifically kind of more the Baathists. What do you anticipate happening after Mosul falls, after Raqqa is retaken? And what do you specifically see happening to the former Baathists?
Okay, and the final question of the evening. Yes, you, sir.
Thank you. I'm Haider Rida from Bain & Company.
the Kurds have been on the front lines for many generations now, but I believe this time is different because the front line is against an enemy not only of the Kurds but of the whole of humanity that is killing, enslaving, raping at a scale that wasn't seen for many hundreds of years. So my question is, how can the Kurds get more stakeholders to join them on that front line so that they don't have to fight that fight so alone, specifically given that we're in London? On the one hand, how could you get more support from corporates like Google, Twitter, marketing agencies, etc., to help you stop the flow of fighters that goes to join ISIS? And secondly, how could you get more support from academic institutions like the LSE or King's or whoever was here? But what can they do to bring facts to the table that are now missing, as about the crimes of ISIS, where they get their money from, where they get their political support from, etc.? So basically, how do you bring in corporate and academic help in that fight, which is so important, which you're fighting? Thank you.
Right, the first question
was quite straightforward. I think it was an either or, which of the coalition support, the material support, or the intelligence has.
I think through the experience we picked up in the past 2 years, having small units, trained, well-equipped smaller units would work much better against ISIL. Talking from experience from my unit, we're a very small unit, but we're better trained. We have better equipment. So bigger armies, they take a lot of casualties because they set up these IEDs and bombs, and that could be really demoralizing for bigger armies. So good intelligence is a key factor. You know, my unit has a big organization, intelligence organization behind it. So we provide the good intelligence to this small unit, well equipped, well trained, and we can really take the fight to ISIL. And we've had a lot of success with them. So it's good intelligence, well trained forces. Smaller units that are much more effective against ISIL, if that may have answered your question.
Now the question up there is quite an intriguing one, and I'll rephrase it to ask two out of the one. The first is, how important do you think former Baathists are in Mosul and in the alleged coalition with Daesh? And then the second one, which was our friend's question, was what happens to them after the liberation?
Yeah, so I think at the beginning of arrival of ISIL, most of the commanders were former Baathist, but it became very clear after a while, after some beheadings of some of these commanders by ISIL, you either gave allegiance to ISIL or you were beheaded. You no longer could be using the Baathist name. You were ISIL. A large number of these guys are former Baathists, but they are now have given allegiance to ISIL. What role they would play or what would happen to them, that would be up to the Iraqi government, whether they will be given a second chance to get back into Iraqi territory. I think that would be up to the Iraqi government. But a lot of these guys could be the guys in creating the next terrorist organization as well. If they're sidelined and they're completely rejected by the Iraqi government, like I said, the breeding ground will be there, and these guys will take advantage of it, and they will create another group under a different name, I believe. And the second question was,
The final question is how can you get more...
There was another question to him, I think. I don't want to...
No?
What
happens to them?
Like I said, if the Iraqi government completely rejects these people, I believe they will be involved in more terrorist activity. So you really have to find a balance there.
It's the stakeholders, the corporate stakeholders. How can they be brought in to support...
Can you give us money? Yeah, on technical side...
Yeah, I don't want to say how much I have in my pocket, but we can talk about that later.
To be honest with you, I don't know how they could help. I know in the past they are cooperating with other intelligence organizations, with international players, to shut down Twitter accounts, to shut down Google account, that helped ISIL recruit in social media. I know there was a program with both Google and
other social media groups. This kind of cooperation is the best way to slow down the process of recruitment by ISIL. I think that, that's the way. And if they can, if they have a lot of money, I know they have a lot of money, they can give us some money because we're short of money at the moment. That would really help.
Okay, on that note, that very practical note and request, it leaves me the very happy task of thanking Lahore Taliban. Although he's got a cold, I think we've all got colds at the moment, it's that time of year, he's given us a very detailed, very frank, I think, very interesting both talk and answer to our questions. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.